from the Sky News Centre at 7. A man who was poisoned by a nerve agent in Wiltshire, which killed his partner, has been released from hospital. Charlie Rowley had been in a critical condition after being exposed to the substance last month, while Dawn Sturgis passed away. Lorna Wilkinson's the director of nursing at Salisbury Hospital.
Charlie has been through an appalling experience most of us could never imagine. Today is a very welcome milestone in his recovery, and all of us here at Salisbury Hospital wish him well as he continues to get better. The progress he has made is a testament to the remarkable clinical team who have worked tirelessly.
It's believed they'd found a small bottle used in a previous nerve agent attack on a former Russian spy and his daughter.
They came from a world that was oppressive, ruled by kings and queens and popes and prelates and bishops and lords and barons, who, just because they didn't like the way you look, could chop you into quarters and throw you to the pigs if they wanted to, anytime they wanted to. And if you didn't believe the religion they wanted you to believe in, they'd burn you at the stake or torture you. They came here to create a new world free from all of that. But they knew that they could not be safe in the new world if the old world was the way that it was. How do you get rid of kings and queens and barons and lords and emperors and prelates and sultans and emirs? A new world order. From the beginning, that was the goal, ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Putin in the White House. Why does detente annoy former CIA Director John Brennan so much? He's the man that journalist Michael Hastings was investigating when his car suddenly accelerated 80 miles an hour and smashed into a tree, even though he had his foot hard down on the brakes. And the new satirical series, What is America?, blatantly stolen from UK broadcast satirist Chris Morris by Sacha Baron Cohen. It's made for a US audience, so why is it the best we can come up with being shown on UK TV? Are we not able to produce our own comedy anymore and our own satire under US media control? And on the week, Israel enshrined racial discrimination in law, the nation state bill. We hear about the secret society, the Pereshim, behind the Zionist movement in the United States. Shocking research from Alison Weir from If Americans Knew on the infiltration of the US government as far back as the late 19th century by this secret group, a transatlantic arrangement to create a Zionist state, using American political and military power, whether the Jews wanted it or not. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, Robert Hansen in Hong Kong talks about the banning of the Hong Kong National Party. And Alison Weir from Americans knew a full interview there on this secret society. No, it's not just the Freemasons and the merchant venturers who like to control public affairs from behind the scenes. Behind the Zionist project, a secret society called the Pereshim. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, we start this week with the Trump-Putin meeting, and also the fallout. And when he returns to the United States, he's been told, we're going to have to impeach you, chum, and also that there will be, well, anyway, some sort of legal action against him, or whatever sort. They don't like it.
Well, yes, I mean, it's fairly predictable, isn't it, that there's going to be a reaction to this. But you saw that what Putin said is, we've actually got an agreement with you where we could interrogate these people for you. You send us the questions you want us to ask them and we will ask them for you. But we would like to actually, under the same agreement, interrogate some of your people about things we're not happy about. So why don't we do a mutual agreement where we'll interrogate people that we're not happy about, who we think have stolen money from us, etc., and then we will in a reciprocal way, you can interview these people to find out what they know.
Who is this guy John Brennan, and why is it that he's getting so upset? Because, I mean, for the vast majority of the, let's try and work this out, what is it, about 200 million people in the US and Britain, we would like to see some détente with the Russians, not escalating tension all the time. Well, I mean, it seems to me as if there's some sort of maybe even covert conflict initiation programme behind the scenes going on.
Well, I think you're absolutely hit the nail on the head. Of course there is. The CIA and the military industrial complex do not want peace to break out. That's the last thing they want. And they are determined to prevent it by any means necessary.
Why?
Because that's the gravy train they're on. You don't get to be head of the CIA with a massive pension and all the rest of it and sit on the boards of various companies making weaponry when you retire by not defending the gravy train that you're on. And, of course, what should happen, the Russians have just decreased their military spending. They've said, we've got enough weaponry now, we've got everything we need, because, of course, they've got a nationalised industry, much more efficient than the privatised industry in the West. And but in the West, of course, they want to spend more and more and more on bigger and bigger pieces of kit, because that is a massive gravy train. You know, all these ex-retired generals and admirals in the United States with all the scrambled egg on their hats, they intend to have a very nice retirement on the back of all of this at the taxpayers' expense.
Just today, things seem to have escalated a little bit more. The Russians actually banging their fists on the table now, saying it looks like their hypersonic missile secrets may have been leaked to the West. The Federal Security Service, the FSB, raided a space research facility after a suspected leak of hypersonic missile secrets to Western spies. The state space agency, Roscosmos, great name, Roscosmos, said its security staff were cooperating with FSB officers on a criminal case. The Sant Daily says 10 staff at Roscosmos facility called TSNII MASH are under suspicion. Director's office was searched. These hypersonic missiles fly at more than 5 times the speed of sound, Mach 5, and apparently they can be nuclear warheads on the end of them.
Well, Putin actually said about these in his speech before he was elected. And I just put this question to you, Tony. Is it fair for the media to report on this? Or are these people getting a fair trial? Are we allowed to know that they've been arrested?
Look, for a start, this is in a foreign country, so
well,
it's a different legal
jurisdiction.
Well, I know,
but, I mean, but in Russia, they could argue, as Cliff Richard has argued, that they shouldn't be named or whatever.
That's a bit of a bogus argument, because each legal jurisdiction, you're not going to get juries in Russia pulled from the streets of Bristol, are you?
No, you're not, but the question is, should we be allowed to, you know, if people have not been charged, should we be allowed to know about a raid?
The international press basically
Good
works
question,
on that
it?
Basis, is that you'll often get a better coverage of your own internal affairs in a foreign country, because there's no restrictions on the freedom of the press.
Indeed, and so if Russia Today had reported about the Cliff Richard thing, they couldn't have been touched, could they? Who could have prosecuted
them? I think they probably did report it, actually, but they do it within the law.
Well, so did the BBC. The law's just been changed by the judge. But anyway, that's, as you say, it's not irrelevant to the circumstances.
What do you make of... I'll tell you what, let's just have a little listen now to the amazing backflip which Donald Trump made this week, when he said, oh, I didn't say that, I said this instead, when he was with... so let's just have a listen. Here he is. Get ready for this, folks. Saying one thing and then saying, sorry, I didn't say that, I said something else.
People came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
I realize that there is a need for some clarification. It should have been obvious. I thought it would be obvious, but I would like to clarify just in case it wasn't. In a key sentence in my remarks, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why I wouldn't or why it wouldn't be Russia. Sort of a double negative. So you can put that in, and I think that probably clarifies things pretty good by itself.
Well, this is about spying on the US and fixing the US elections, the so-called Russiagate scandal, Martin. I don't see any reason why it would be. It's rather different to I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia fixing the elections.
Well, what that says to me is any deal that Vladimir Putin did with Trump ain't worth the toilet paper it's written on. So it's all very well to talk to him, and you can humour him, but there's no point trying to do deals with him, because he's basically got the CIA's hand up his back anyway. Whatever he thinks, it's largely irrelevant.
So what's the point of having these meetings with in North Korea or Russia? It's pointless, is it?
Well, it's not entirely pointless. He is the official head of state, and you might as well, if they're prepared to talk to you, talk to them. But it's no point trying to do deals with people who can't deliver their own side, and he can't deliver his own side. You might as well talk to him, because you might find something useful out, and you might be able to agree on something small. There's no point trusting him. I mean, he said he was the one who carried out with Theresa May and Macron carried out the missile strikes on Syria, and the OPCW chemical weapons people have said, well, there was no evidence of.
But weren't they largely theatrical? In other words, that the other side was warned where they were going to go, and they mostly hit innocuous targets.
Well, but at the same time, it's still an act of war, and the Russians could interpret that we're going shoot back.
So the idea really here is this is just for a Western public watching television audience, this missile strike. Is that really what you're saying?
Well, we're not quite sure. I mean, it did some damage. If let's put it this way. If the Syrians had fired missiles at Akrotiri RAF base and didn't kill anybody but just managed to damage a couple of aircraft, we'd still regard that as an act of war, wouldn't we? And of course, what they could have done is said, no, don't forget they've taken hundreds of thousands of casualties, the Syrian army. Maybe if you're going to fire weaponry at us with dangerous weaponry, we're going to fire back at you, and maybe some RAF personnel are going to lose limbs, eyes, heads, and then their children back in private school in England go, oh, my daddy's been hurt. That's warfare. That's the real business.
We've had a couple of amazing instances of fake news. I mean, literally going all around the world and then suddenly changing. The first one was a few weeks ago with this Ukrainian journalist who said that he'd been murdered and then suddenly appeared at his own press conference. And now this week we had an incredible half of a day. I mean, literally from about 8 a.m. till 1 noon or 1 p.m., the entire world's press was saying that the British police had been looking at CCTV footage and discovered that there were a whole bunch of Russians that they tracked to having come into the country that they'd managed to find using facial recognition software on CCTV running around in Salisbury.
Well, yes, and as you say, they had to backtrack and say, well, actually, we haven't seen that this is all, we didn't see this at all. Don't forget that Boris Johnson said that Poulton Down had told him that it was definitely Russian-made Novichok, and then Poulton Down came out and said, well, no, it wasn't. And, of course, the people who ran the hospital in Salisbury were also saying, well, actually, there's only three people treated for poisoning. They didn't say Novichok poisoning. So, that you know, there's an awful lot of disinformation out there being pushed by intelligence services who've got a vested interest to push it.
This is CNN and the Press Association, so I suppose if the intelligence services can manage to get ins into things like Associated Press, Press Association, Reuters, CNN, possibly one of the other big US networks, BBC, can they actually just say, well, here's a little piece of paper, here's the news, just print this out? And is there any kind of reason why the journalists involved in doing all this at the Press Association, wherever else, would actually check the facts before they print it and circulate it around the world?
Well, they ought to, but they don't. And don't forget, the way it works is if you want privileged information, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, from the intelligence services, you've got to report it the way they want it, otherwise they're not going to give it to you. And therefore, you basically, if you look in the Daily Telegraph, quite frequently, there are articles that are quite clearly written by MI6, but somebody else has got their byline on it. And if you want to make a career in journalism of that kind, then that's a nice career to be made. And if you don't, then there's the door.
This faked Russian journalist murder I mentioned a little while ago, Arkady Babchenko, and this case in Salisbury and in Amesbury, it smacks to me as if it's blatant and obvious news management. So you're getting one part of the story coming out, and then suddenly it's reversing. We're all around the world. The story reverses, something else is going on.
Yeah, but what that does, it creates the image in you know, people's minds are not paying too much attention, that something terrible has happened. You're not quite sure what, but it's the Russians to blame, and we all know that they're behind everything. And that's the game. I mean, why did the intelligence services in the US indict 12 Russian intelligence officers the day before Putin met Trump? And that's because they're trying to sabotage the meeting. They're not serving the president. They've got their own agenda. That's pretty obvious, isn't it? You'd be a fool not to recognise
this. This whole Russian Novichok business came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Keith Simpson! My right honourable friend should be commended for her sang-froid a week ago in dealing with a giant ego, somebody who believes that truth is fake news, leaks continually, and I'm not referring here to the right honourable gentleman for Uxbridge. I'm, of course, referring to President Trump. He has acted in a very bizarre way over intelligence. Mm-hmm. I know my right honourable friend has to work with him, but is she not alarmed at the way in which he refused to challenge President Putin over the Russian activity which resulted recently in the death of a young woman here in Salisbury? Prime Minister!
Can I say to my honourable friend, I understand that there have been some clarifications, excuse me, of some of the statements that President Trump made. I think I did raise the incident in Salisbury, what happened in Salisbury, and the fact that we have seen somebody here in the UK die as a result of contact with a nerve agent. I did raise that with President Trump. Of course, at the time that we took immediate action after the Salisbury attack, when we had been able to attribute that to Russia, the United States stood alongside us, as did many other nations across the world, and took action against Russia, which showed a united international front that we gave a very clear message. We will not accept this behaviour. This is not behaviour that Russia can conduct with impunity, and we will continue to act together.
Well, I mean, they haven't actually produced any evidence to link these deaths, and we now have a death, to Russia, and there are basically fundamental problems with the whole story from the get-go. If it's Novichok, for example, as they claim it is, they should all be dead. You touch Novichok, you die immediately. Not after going to the pub, going to the park, having a row in a restaurant, and then suddenly, simultaneously, getting frothing at the mouth on a park bench. That's not how Novichok works. You touch it, you die. And the same is true of the other two. If this woman had touched Novichok in a perfume bottle, which is what we're now being told, she would die immediately, straight away, dead straight away, and the other person too. You'd just die straight away. So there's a fundamental problem here. And they're saying, well, Porton Down wouldn't lie. Well, Porton Down is a British intelligence-led organisation.
They do lie, because they lied about the the various service people who had been used as guinea pigs, effectively, there over many years. And in fact, this is actually in very recent history. It's only about, I think, 2006, 2005, that they were finally forced to pay out for those.
Well, the other thing that I'd like to point out to our listeners is that as Craig Murray, who was the former British ambassador in Uzbekistan, pointed out, the Soviet chemical weapons equivalent of Porton Down was based in Uzbekistan, and it was completely dismantled by American staff during the Yeltsin era, and the Russians have been given a clean bill of health. They've got rid of all of their chemical weapons. We were supposed to get rid of our chemical weapons.
Is this
but you
story?
Know what? Not only are we not getting rid of chemical weapons, on the back of this incident, Porton Down's going to get another great big slab of taxpayer money to produce more.
Is the story of the perfume bottle credible, do you think?
I don't believe anything that we're being told by Her Majesty's government about this. I believe that our own intelligence services would be the most likely suspects to be behind all of this which means they've murdered somebody here, but that's the kind of thing they do.
This is a binary substance, so it would have to be two perfume bottles, surely, if a perfume bottle was
There's all sorts of things that just don't add up. And we know from there's a French anti-terrorist squad officer called Paul Burrell who gave an interview a couple of years ago, and he said, well, there's an ongoing programme to destabilise relations with Russia. Russia, and it's a NATO operation, and it's called Operation Beluga. And we are, you know, what seems to happen is whenever there's a chance of some kind of reasonable conversation taking place, suddenly an incident occurs which prevents that conversation from coming, from bearing fruit. So, and the same goes with with Trump said he was going to withdraw from Syria, and then suddenly the White Helmets tell us that there's a chemical weapons attack, and suddenly we're all firing missiles at Syria, even though Trump has actually flagged up that he wants to withdraw from Syria. But
that happened just like literally 3 days before.
That's right. So in actual fact, what we've got is a situation where Trump says whatever he likes and changes his mind every 2 minutes about what he's actually said, but he's not actually in charge. The Pentagon's in charge. I'm quite sure the Russian general staff are very well aware of that.
Well, he's in charge, isn't he, just about, but he's surrounded by people who are bamboozling him constantly.
Well, probably just as well, because if he was in charge, he'd probably be more dangerous.
Before we get away from the Skripal affair, really, you think so?
Well, I think the fact is that none of them are fit to be running the United States of America. None of them. It must be very scary if you're on the Russian
side
trying to deal with
them. Trump surely is making an effort at détente of some sort, whereas obviously the CIA and the rest of them just want a war.
No, I know, and when he does things right, he should be encouraged. But the fact is, nobody on the Russian side should put any faith in what Trump says. He changes his mind. You see what he just did? He just changed what he said one thing, and then he pretended he'd said something else. And that's because he's not to be trusted. And basically, there's no point doing deals with him. You might as well talk to him, because then he'll report back and so on, and you might get something out of it. But there's no point trusting him. Who would trust him?
Now,
who would trust any of them?
A sad, funny story of Sergei and Yulia. Not funny, ha-ha, but funny, peculiar. One Sunday in March, they decided to eat at a nice little cafe, then stopped at a seat where they both felt unwell at the very same minute. Now, I think that's quite a coincidence, isn't it? So an ambulance came for the pair as requested, but when they were studied and prodded and tested, nefarious substances in them were found. And not only there, but spread all around old Salisbury town, up hill and down valley. The high street is now known as Chemical Alley. A passing DS who just happened to be there was poisoned like them when he went off to see where they lived. Or did he succumb at the scene? His bosses told two different stories on screen. Now, that goes on and on and on, but you sent me that during the week. It's a great little poem, actually, and it does kind of send up the whole affair, really.
It does, and also you'll notice that he's put loads of links in it. He's not just making a poem up. There's lots of links that show why these rather barbed, poetic, doggerel is making a serious point. The fact is, the most likely explanation for what happened in Salisbury is it's part of Operation Beluga, which is an ongoing NATO intelligence service operation to discredit Russia and prevent peace. That's most by far the most. If Wiltshire police were allowed to investigate, that should be their top.
Getting back to the Trump-Putin press conference, there was actually a guy dragged out, wasn't there? A journalist from The Nation magazine in the United States actually dragged out. And he didn't actually do anything. He was just holding up something about the nuclear deal, which was he was trying to get the attention of the person who was allowing them to ask the questions to Trump and Putin about the anti-nuclear treaty.
Well, I mean, I didn't know that, so what happened?
Okay, well, anyway, he got dragged out, basically. Okay. And anyway, let's have a listen to him now. I had no coverage at all anywhere on our mainstream press about who he was and what he was talking about. So let's have a listen to him now. And he appeared on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! This week.
This month is 50 years since the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was supposed to strike a deal. The nuclear powers, the U.S., Russia, and the others, would agree that they would move towards elimination, good faith efforts at elimination of their nuclear weapons in return for the other countries not acquiring nuclear weapons. The U.S. has totally reneged on that. So after this has become evident, some countries moved to this nuclear ban treaty. The group behind it, ICAN, won the Nobel Peace Prize last year. This has gotten ridiculously little coverage, ridiculously little understanding in the U.S. and elsewhere. And that was what I was highlighting, that these men who would go on in the news conference to talk about proliferation and about how responsible they are. Proliferation, non-proliferation, is an Orwellianism in a sense, because what it's saying is we get to have our nukes and nobody else does. We maintain the monopoly of violence in the world. We will threaten the world for our geostrategic interests. That's fundamentally what's going on here. They can scream at each other, the U.S. establishment and the Russian establishment, just as the Democratic establishment and the Republican establishment scream at each other. And meanwhile, the wars that they both want continue, the economic exploitation that they want continue. So levels of volume of alleged screaming when you're talking about Democratic Pharisees and Republican Sadducees doesn't indicate actual animosity, in my view. It's a way of drowning out some people who might be attempting to divine a measure of truth and freedom in our current circumstance.
Sam Husseini, who was dragged out of the Putin-Trump press conference rather unceremoniously. Now, Martin, what he's saying there effectively is that...
Was it in Helsinki? Was that in the US?
Yeah, in Helsinki. And this is actually... But he was dragged out, let's just be clear about this, not by Russians, but by Finns,
right.
By the Western democratic process, decided that for having literally having a banner, it wasn't a banner, it was a small piece of cardboard. He was trying to get the attention and pointing to his piece of cardboard of the chair. He wasn't asked any questions like, can you please put the cardboard down? He was just literally dragged out. And this is the so-called free Western press.
Well, press conferences are relatively free or not free.
Why didn't they just allow him to ask his question? He sounds like a very smart, intelligent guy.
Yeah,
and he's saying, effectively, that what's going on there is a big piece of theatre.
Well, I mean, press conferences are theatre, Tony, as you're well aware.
Between the massive superpowers, none of whom is better than any of the other ones.
Well, I mean, the fact is that a lot of this is stage managed. We know this, don't we? I mean, does anybody think anything else is going on?
Yeah, I think some people do. But, I mean, what he's saying effectively here is that when people are having their big... When you were talking there about the Republicans and Democrats, here it's Labour and Conservative. He's saying that actually they're both two sides of the same coin. I mean, particularly in the US, surely that for him as a writer, that's true, isn't it? When you've got the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. The idea is to create a big fuss, all the public look at it, and nothing actually gets done except for what the elite want.
Well, indeed. I mean, the setup is incredibly flawed. We don't really have democracy in the West. They don't really have it in Russia either. It's a work in progress, and in actual fact, we've been going backwards over recent years in the West. I don't think there's any doubt about it. The Russians have been going forwards. They're improving their democracy. Ours is degenerating, such as it is.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Over to Hong Kong now, and there's been a really important development over there. There's a new party formed recently called the Hong Kong National Party, which has only got a very few members, but their plan is to campaign. They don't really have any political power at all at the moment, but to campaign for pro-independence from China. Now they've got till the end of the month, just over the end of the month, to give a good reason why they should be able to exist, or the people involved in it will, the party will be banned, and those involved will be criminals.
Are you asking me about this? Well, I mean, the situation in Hong Kong is that it was supposed to be one system. No, two systems, one country. And in Hong Kong, before the British left, they basically didn't have any democracy. It was run by Britain. And the Chinese said, well, we want to take it over as a going concern with no democracy. So they don't complain that they want democracy now. There was no democracy when the British ran it.
Do you not think that the people in Hong Kong deserve some sort of...
Well, they probably do. But the fact is that the agreement between Britain and China was that they would take it over as it was being run. And I'm sure they're justified in having their views or whatever. But as you say, they haven't actually got a lot of support. So the Chinese would probably be wise to just let them have their party.
The idea clearly is to nip this in the bud. In fact, the idea obviously is to ban any kind of political activity which is against the Chinese Communist Party rule of Hong Kong.
Yes, and just as the British didn't allow anybody to, you know, when they were running it, they were pretty clear about, we're running this. You know, this isn't, and Hong Kong wasn't said it was a democratic state. Never was. It's a place of commerce. And, of course, maybe it should be democratic. Maybe Britain should be democratic. Maybe the US should be democratic.
I mean, we had a movement, the Umbrella Movement, a few years ago over there, with literally tens of thousands of young people from Hong Kong saying, actually, we don't really want to have our freedoms here. I mean, whether it's democratic or whatever, there is a certain amount of freedom in Hong Kong that the Chinese want to take away.
Well, as you remember, you interviewed when you were in Hong Kong, you interviewed a journalist from the Hong Kong Press Association, an American guy who's been based over there for years, and he said, yes, they did have some support, but not really. The older generation didn't join in. And the Chinese authorities in Hong Kong basically ignored the Umbrella Revolution, and eventually everybody got bored and went home. Because in actual fact, the majority of
people...
No,
that's not true, no, because there was a court case and the police came and broke up the protest.
Yes, okay, so there's tension there. Listen, I'm not saying that people in Hong Kong aren't entitled to their views. If they want independence from China, they can agitate
the Chinese.
But the rules are that by agreement with the British, and the Chinese are not going to accept Hong Kong breaking away from China.
The Chinese have got some pretty weird views, haven't they, about the way people should behave. They're just bringing in this thing called the social credit system. And it's going to be on dialect next Tuesday at noon. But here's a little extract from a chat I had with Richard Hansen from Hong Kong about this social credit system. And a lot of people who live in Hong Kong are extremely nervous and worried about this kind of thing happening in Hong Kong at the moment. It's only in mainland China.
A social credit system is, if you do minor things wrong, you get points. But like in a car, if you do minor driving offences, you might get 3 points, 4 points, or 5 points. And when you get to a certain level of points, you get banned from doing certain activities. So if, for example, you cross the road at a point where you have those green men crossings, pelican crossings, and it's on red, and you cross on red, you'll get a few negative points. And if you do that enough times, you'll get suspended from travelling for a certain period of time.
I mean, this is sounding pretty damn authoritarian, if you ask me.
Well, it sounds very much like Singapore, which is run by capitalists, right, but has very similar kind of rules. You're not allowed to put chewing gum on the park benches, and you go to prison, and you can get caned in Singapore for putting chewing gum on park benches.
Is this just the way it should be, or has to be in Southeast Asia?
No, I'm just saying that there are different traditions in different parts of the world. Confucianism puts a strong emphasis upon social hierarchy and deference. It's not the same as the Wild West, but then it isn't the Wild West.
Another international story, it's just a few weeks ago, which we didn't cover at the time. Sorry about that. Chlorine used in Syria's Duma. No trace of any nerve agent, the OPCW report finds. Now, this has got virtually no coverage, has it? If you compare to the week of wall-to-wall coverage of this so-called chemical weapons attack, actually there was no nerve agent used. We're now being told by the Organisation for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. And yet, have British people been informed of that?
Well, this is what happens. The original story runs out, and don't forget the White Helmets, which are the source of it, are Al-Qaeda linked and funded by the British and US taxpayers. And in other words, the whole story was probably orchestrated by intelligence operatives in the West. And the purpose of that was to, set up Assad, set up Syria, so that the British, the French and the Americans could then fire missiles into Syria, which did damage, but as far as we know, didn't kill anybody. And of course, there was a deal done that would happen probably. But of course, it's quite possible the Syrian army, who've taken tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of casualties, might say, well, it's about time for the RAF to take one for the team, and we're going to fire back and we're going to kill some of your people and see how you like that, because we're fed up of you firing missiles at us. As what was it Michael Caine said years ago, do not point that thing at me. And of course the West just presumes that they can get away with this, and they do, until they don't. I presume when the counterattack comes, if it comes, it won't be a pinprick counterattack.
It's funny you should mention that, because the organisation Veterans for Peace UK, which I would urge any ex-forces veterans to have a look at them, they were at Armed Forces Day apparently, up, I think it was in Blackpool, someone like that, in Lancashire, and they came across a group of Royal Marines who were trying to recruit school children. Obviously not directly into the army, but they were, you know, sort of having a lot of play where you can have a play with automatic weapons. Obviously, they didn't have, I imagine, they had no firing pins. They were made sort of neutral, whatever. And then these children were being encouraged to sort of point the guns around the area at people. Now, a Veterans for Peace commentator who wrote the piece about it said, well, hang on a minute, in our basic training, one of the first things we were taught is you never, ever, ever point a weapon at someone unless you intend to kill them. But they're teaching children to do this.
Well, I mean, they're finding it hard to recruit people, and it's not surprising, is it? You know, do you really want to go and die in Afghanistan for something you don't understand?
Do you think there's a real lack of... It's becoming more difficult to actually get people to join the army these days, because actually there is a big, big difference, isn't there, to defending your country and doing things which are in defence of freedom in one way or another, and doing illegal invasions, black operations. In fact, we've seen a massive increase in the number of special forces which are completely outside the control of Parliament. They're run directly by the intelligence services and by the Ministry of Defence, and... you know, the army themselves effectively running these, and they don't have to have any kind of scrutiny. In fact, they don't have any votes in Parliament about whether special forces can be running around in Syria, Russia, China, or anywhere like that. So that they've increased massively the number of those.
Well, yeah, but if we come back to the actual missile strikes on Syria, there is a convention in this country that Parliament should have been recalled, because that's basically an act of war. What if the Syrians and the Russians fire back? We're at war with Syria and Russia. That's what Parliament is supposed to decide, not the Prime Minister. And of course, what happened was they didn't fire back by agreement, but they might have said, we're not having an agreement. You shoot at us, we're going to shoot back. And of course, Parliament should have been recalled. It wasn't. Why not?
Pakistani have given the army broad election powers, the polling stations. Is Imran Khan going to be president by this time next week?
I've no idea. I understand that the army are pushing him and would like him to be the president. But Nawaz Sharif has been arrested and accused of various shenanigans and so on. It's a very, very unstable situation.
I mean, it's one of those countries that you do think, well, we don't get much news from there, but actually it's been a major part of the destabilisation by NATO and the West has been off Pakistan.
Yes, well, don't forget, in the 1980s, under Operation Cyclone, Pakistan and the ISI worked very closely with our military to set up what became Al-Qaeda. And the ISI were intimately involved in all of that. So were our people.
The assassination of Benazir Bhutto was covered recently on the BBC. I think it was on the World at One or something. They were doing regular pieces about it. Absolute rubbish, because there was no real proper investigation. I mean, I just, at the time, remember digging out some photographs of the scene of Benazir Bhutto's assassination just before. I mean, do you think she would have... she may have become president. She just returned to take over, or at least to run. And there was a picture of a woman with a gun pointing at her head just before she was. There was an explosion. Now, we're still told that there was a bomb that blew up the cavalcade. And actually, you can see quite clearly the bomb was almost certainly a distraction. There'd been an assassin sent in to shoot her dead. And then once it was clear that she'd been, you know, shot maybe a couple of bullets in somewhere vital, then the bomb went off as a distraction. So, I mean, this is the sort of thing that seems to be completely unreported or underreported.
Well, the fact is, if you look at Dawn, for example, which is an English language newspaper from Pakistan, there's actually a much better understanding in Pakistan of how intelligence services actually operate. You know, in Britain, where people get freaking out about Novichok and so on the basis of James Bond films from the 1960s, in Pakistan, people die every day in terrorist attacks by various organisations, some connected to the state, some opposed to the state, some working with other foreign states, and everybody knows that everything that you're told is a lie. So, for example, most of the Pakistani shopkeepers around here, when I chatted to them about the so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden, just rolled their eyes. Nobody in Pakistan believes the story the Americans told about that. They just don't believe it, and they're right not to believe it, because it's a load of nonsense.
Just today we hear a major escalation in Gaza. The Israelis launched a massive attack, says Haaretz, after Hamas snipers fired at troops. Well, I don't think they actually killed anybody.
Well, we don't even know that they fired. We just got the Israelis' word for it.
Yeah, four Hamas members have been killed, anyway, in an Israeli attack after snipers target Israeli soldiers. There's about a 100-to-1 kill ratio, isn't there, in Israel, where 100 Palestinians are killed roughly for every one Israeli.
And also, of course, we are basically being fed stories about what happened where things may not have happened. Do we know that there was a Hamas sniper attack? We've only got the IDF's word for it, and they tend to lie, because it's all, you know, by deception to make war.
And is that what they're doing?
I'm not sure, but I don't believe them necessarily when they say so and so and so and so. I just go, well, okay, that's what you're saying. Don't believe it necessarily. Why should I?
Trump is also saying that his critics badly want war with Russia. Is that...
I think that's an exaggeration. They don't want war with Russia. They want tension with Russia so they can spend loads of money on useless things like aircraft carriers, etc. If it comes to a war with Russia, as the Russians, have, as I said earlier, are reducing their military spending because they're pretty confident that if it comes to a war with them in the defensive, which is all they're ever going to be, they're going to win. And that's why they probably won't do it, because they'll lose.
Trump has also been warning, hasn't he, that the NATO collective defence could start a third world war.
Well, this is the problem with this. It's not that anybody wants... there are people in the West who keep talking about war, 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 like all the people still banging the drum for us to go to war with Assad in Syria. And, of course, the point is, if you get to a war, you might lose. I mean, you know, people who buy wars from warmongers should read the small print. And you've got to look very close to get your magnifying glass out. It says, wars can be lost as well as won, and the warmonger takes no responsibility for this result. It's like gambling. You can gamble if you like, but then you can lose your money.
What do you think Putin will be turning up at the White House in the autumn?
I think it's unlikely, because enormous pressure put on Trump not to do it. And if I was Putin, I'd be very careful about putting myself in a situation like that where they've got complete control of the environment.
I mean, he's got
Hugo Chavez died
just
of,
a minute. Died he's of, got his own security detail. Maybe he'll have his own chef with him.
Well, maybe he will, because if he's going to, I would suggest that he does. I mean, Hugo Chavez was warned by Fidel Castro.
The Russians are capable of protecting Putin. If they're not,
well,
I mean,
Putin's favourite driver was killed in a very bizarre car accident a couple of years ago. Did you
but
see
that's
that?
His driver. That's not
yes, but I mean, that's sending a message, isn't it? The fact is that the people who run the United States of America are gangsters. Many people in Latin America believe that the left-wing leaders like Kirchner, the Kirchners in Argentina, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, were assassinated by CIA operatives. They all died. Chavez died of... He had three bouts of cancer, all very bizarre, unusual cancers. And he had the top Cuban medical personnel looking after him, but eventually he died. And many people in Venezuela, and it's not an unreasonable suspicion, think that he was murdered by the Americans, because that's the kind of thing they do. Yeah, they make Al Capone's only a low-level gangster. These are much higher-level.
Before we get off the... Well, I mean, it's actually, you do wonder, don't you, if actually the mafia is... I mean, I think we had this a couple of weeks ago, that the first industry to globalise, Daniel Hopsicker said this, was organised crime.
Well, exactly, and Meyer Lansky, who created Las Vegas, worked very closely with the CIA for years and years and years. Pablo Escobar's son in Colombia said, "Well, my dad worked for the CIA." Everybody knows that, don't they?
I wonder if
Theresa May knows it.
Back to the domestic stuff, connected in a way, but what do you make of these new proposals to have a British spaceport? I don't know if you remember, we had Dave Barnby in here a couple of years ago talking about the Black Arrow project, which was scrapped in the early 1970s by Edward Heath when we went into the European Union, which was a British ballistic rocket thing that was there to send satellites into space, but that was all scrapped because we became part of the European Space Project. So, I mean, it is going to be necessary, surely, for us to put satellites into space, because we've got this enormous problem with leaving the European Union. We will no longer be able to use their GPS system, so apparently many of our sat-navs will simply stop working. And it's more importantly, actually, a military system that will stop working. The military won't have access reliable GPS.
Well, I don't really know enough about this to comment. We'll have to see.
I mean, we will have to have our own satellite system, won't we?
Well, I mean, at one stage, the reason why the Ariane satellite system is set up and so on is because otherwise it's all run by the Americans. And, you know, that's why the European Union had a separate system.
Well, it is now the Trident technology is all US. Surely they can stop, they can control it if they want.
Yeah, well, I'd just point out that both the Chinese and the Russians have developed anti-satellite weaponry. When the fight starts, if it does start, all of these satellites are going to go straight down the drain. And they will be able to fight without satellites, and we won't, because they're training to fight without satellites. All this high-tech GPS is incredibly vulnerable to straightforward rocketry. And this is one of the reasons why there possibly won't be a war, because the generals on the Western side, if they actually look at it objectively, realise that if we fight, we're going to lose. And that's possibly that's good news for humanity.
It's the far north of Scotland. They're talking about putting this spaceport in between Tongue and Durness, which is on the Amoyne Peninsula, right at the very, very top. Not far, by the way, from where good old Robin Cook keeled over in a rather suspicious way back in, I think it was 2005. So is that going to be a good place to have a Britain's Cape Canaveral?
Well, I don't know, Tony, but the point is that all of these things are targets, aren't they? If I was living in the area, you've got to realise that the other side are going to shoot at something like that if it comes to a fight.
And it does seem a little bit late in the whole Brexit process to realise that, crikey, we're going to have to be able to put satellites into space.
Well, we talked about Brexit earlier. There's been no real, it's turning into a complete shambles. It's quite likely, to be honest with you, that they'll either have to extend the deadline, it won't happen, or there'll be a general election, and then when you've got a different government, it'll be a different negotiation.
Now, let's talk about this Jewish nation state law, which has come in this week. There's also this big assault on Gaza. We've just heard another one. So this bill is going to allow Jews and Arabs to be segregated. The Law of Jewish Supremacy, some are calling it, son of the former Prime Minister Menachem Begin, founder of Netanyahu's Likud party, actually abstained from the vote. He warned about the party's growing disconnect from human rights. So the bill is passed. It means Israel is the historic homeland of the Jewish people, who have the unique right of national self-determination. Flag and the menorah, national symbols, well, we already know that, really. Jerusalem will be the capital, not Tel Aviv. And there's a whole another list, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and a link to some articles detailing this law, because it really is a totally and utterly racially supremacist law.
Well, in other words, they're coming out of the closet as an apartheid state, and therefore they have to face sanctions. And I would suggest that the other thing that has to happen is they may lose their seat at the United Nations. There's various, Kosovo doesn't have a seat at the United Nations, Kashmir doesn't have a seat at the United Nations. Why should Israel, if they're not going to play by the rules? That doesn't mean that we're going to go to war with them, necessarily, but there's no reason why we should give them a seat at the United Nations. If they're not going to play by the rules, why should we?
Well, we're going to hear now from Alison Weir, and she's from If Americans Knew, a non-profit organisation over in the US, about the infiltration of the American government as far back as the late 19th century by a secret group.
So we're talking about in the late 1800s, there was already a movement in the US to create a Jewish state in Palestine, even though at that time Palestine was fully inhabited and its population was about 95% non-Jewish. It was about 80% Muslim and about 15% Christian, a little under 5% Jewish. So that movement worldwide originally was not really very successful. Most Jews around the world, including within Palestine itself, opposed Zionism. Then in 1914, a prominent American Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis, who's very famous, there's a university named after him. He's held in high regard by most Americans, especially those of us that are liberals or progressives, have always respected Brandeis. Well, it turns out that he became the head of World Zionism around 1914 or so. And then he was appointed to the Supreme Court by Woodrow Wilson. When you become a member of the Supreme Court, the normal behavior is to resign your board affiliations and your connections to various organizations because you're supposed to be neutral, or at least to be perceived as neutral. So Brandeis officially resigned his leadership of the World Zionist Organization, but a number of books disclose this. He remained its leader for quite a while, and his loyal lieutenants would come into the Supreme Court chambers where Brandeis would give them directives to carry out. This is very little known by most Americans and is really considered highly unethical behavior. Then, to get into more of your question and the aspect of this that would probably be more interesting to English listeners, is that Brandeis became not only was he the head of World Zionism, but he was a leader in what was, according to an article in a scholarly journal, a peer-reviewed Jewish scholarly journal, he was a leader in a secret Zionist society called the Parashim. Normally, I'm not one who believes or expects to find, quote, secret societies, but this was from the U.S. Jewish Historical Quarterly. It's also discussed in a mainstream book by a highly regarded author named Peter Gross, who was at the New York Times for many years, then at Harvard, wrote a number of nonfiction books. So I discovered this connection that Brandeis had to that society. And then reading from Dr. Sarah Schmidt, who's an Israeli professor, and Peter Gross, the American who used to be the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, write that a leader of the Parashim, a man named Horace Kallen, who was a professor first at Princeton, then at the University of Wisconsin, came up with the idea of suggesting to the British that they would gain a benefit from announcing a policy in support of Zionism, of creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This idea was suggested by Professor Kallen, an American, and made its way to Britain through various intermediaries in 1915. Now, at that time, Britain really had nothing to do with Palestine. Palestine at that time was under the Ottoman Empire. It was not yet under the British Empire, huge as the British Empire was. The sun did set on the British Empire in Palestine because Palestine was under the Ottomans. So why would Kallen suggest that the British would benefit from announcing a policy supporting Zionism? Well, the reason, it turns out, and this is in a number of books. If people get my book, you'll see that it's thoroughly cited. My book is half footnotes, literally. So everything I say, people can look at the source for it. In 1915, as I'm sure we all remember, that was World War I, what was called at the time the Great War. Britain was desperate to have the U.S. come into its side of the war. The first day of battle of the Battle of the Somme, British casualties were about 60,000 men in one day of battle. The problem from Britain's point of view and from the Zionists' point of view, as we'll see later, but from Britain's point of view, was that Americans did not want to enter the, quote, Great War. It had nothing to do with Americans. It was far away and really had really little interest to Americans. Woodrow Wilson was reelected to office with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But as I think I just said, the British government very much wanted the U.S. to come in on their side of the war. The Zionist leadership in Britain, especially a man named Chaim Weizmann, who later became president of Israel, went to the British government, and he made the claim that he and his colleagues in the U.S., and he especially referred to Brandeis, who was at that time in the Supreme Court and a good friend of Woodrow Wilson, he claimed that through Brandeis and other colleagues in the U.S., they could influence the U.S. to join the war on the side of Britain. And they said that they would do that if Britain would promise that it would then facilitate their efforts to have a Jewish state in Palestine. This is in a number of books, and it was referred to as the Gentleman's Agreement. This is how the Zionists, Israel partisans, although it wasn't yet Israel, so we have to use the political term, which is Zionists, managed to obtain this declaration. Mild as it is, really, in some ways, it opened the door to colonization of Palestine by Jewish immigrants and colonists. This is how they obtained the Balfour Declaration. And another very interesting aspect of it that, again, most of us didn't know, but it seems to be corroborated in a number of books, is that the actual author of the Declaration was not Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister at the time. It was actually a secret Zionist named Leopold Amory. Again, this came out from a Jewish historian who's a very eminent Jewish historian, wrote about this in an article that I first read in the San Francisco Jewish Bulletin, and in a more extensive article and elsewhere, he goes into more detail about Leopold Amory and his secret connections to Zionism and how much he worked so on behalf of Zionism within the British government. And he was the one that authored the final wording of what's called the Balfour Declaration.
Alison Weir there. Her book is Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the US Was Used to Create Israel. So some fascinating stuff there and a bit of a revelation. But Martin, you have to kind of get her book, really, because it's got all the references where she's got all this stuff from in there.
Yeah, well, it all sounds pretty accurate. I've read a book recently about J&M Jeffries, who was the Daily Mail's correspondent in Palestine at the time, and he made it his life's work to expose the shenanigans that went around the Balfour Declaration.
So, according to Craig Murray, the former ambassador, Israel is now openly and unblushingly racist apartheid state with yesterday's new law. Criticising that fact is anti-Semitic under the crazed definition endorsed by the British government, but not quite yet by the Labour Party. It does seem as if this is all going on at the same time. So we've got an extremist racist state being solidified, and at the same time, anyone that criticises it in the Labour Party will be expelled.
Yeah, well, we know because of the Al Jazeera sting that was carried out that the Israeli embassy in Britain has got £1 million to spend inside the Labour Party getting the results they want. And I have to say to Margaret Hodge and others, have you ever taken any money from the Israelis?
Isn't it MI5's job and the security services' job to stop foreign countries interfering in British politics?
Only in lower sixth A-level politics lectures. MI5 work very closely with various powerful groups, including the Israeli lobby, to do what they do, and they're subpoenaed. They've all been suborned.
Just one last story. Google is facing a record $5 billion fine in the European Union, ordered to remove Google Chrome from Android. But it doesn't seem. It seems almost a pathetic small thing for the European Union to get Google to do, because obviously Android as a operating system is. There is no proper security to it, and Google have got the ability to just get into everyone's phone that they feel like at any time.
Well, they are the robber barons of today, aren't they? And they use the monopoly power to try and increase their power, and they work very closely with the intelligence services, and that, of course, could lead to them being sued by their customers for a breach of contract, which could end up being like a PPI scandal. As our friend Kevin Cahill has said.
Okay, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Thanks to our old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Mohammed Mkawi's next with Arabian Nights. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon at dialectradio.co.uk. You'll find this show's podcast story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let those banksters get you down.
News on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.